content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the March 15, 2023 online edition of the New Yorker. Nicholas Humphrey's Beautiful Theory of Mind. In his new book, Sentience, a neuropsychologist argues that consciousness evolved to make us feel that life is worth living, by Nick Romeo. One night in 1966, a 23-year-old graduate student named Nicholas Humphrey was working in a darkened psychology lab at the University of Cambridge. An anesthetized monkey sat before him. Glowing targets moved across a screen in front of the animal, and Humphrey, using an electrode, recorded the activity of nerve cells in its superior colliculus, an ancient brain area involved in visual processing. The superior colliculus predates the more advanced visual cortex, which enables conscious sight in mammals. Although the monkey was not awake, the cells in its superior colliculus were firing anyway, their activation registering as a series of crackles issuing from a loudspeaker. Humphrey seemed to be listening to the brain cells seeing. This suggested a startling possibility. Some type of vision might be possible without any conscious sensation. A few months later, Humphrey approached the cage of a monkey named Helen. Her visual cortex had been removed by his supervisor, but her superior colliculus was still intact. He sat beside her, waving and trying to interest her. Within a few hours, she began grasping chunks of apple from his hand. Over the following years, Humphrey worked intensively with Helen. On the advice of a primatologist, he took her for walks on a leash in the village of Mattingly, near Cambridge. At first, she collided with objects and with Humphrey. Several times, she fell into a pond. But soon she learned to navigate her surroundings. On walks, Helen would move directly across a field to climb a favorite tree. She would reach for fruit and nuts Humphrey offered her, but only if they were within arm's length, which suggested that she had depth perception. In the lab, she could find peanuts and currants scattered across a floor strewn with obstacles. Once, she collected 25 currants from an area of 50 square feet in less than a minute. This was not the behavior of an animal without sight. As Humphrey tried to understand Helen's condition, he recalled an influential distinction made by the 18th century Scottish philosopher Thomas Reid between perception and sensation. Perception, Reid wrote, registers information about objects in the external world. Sensation is a subjective feeling that accompanies perceptions. Because we encounter sensations and perceptions simultaneously, we conflate them. But there's a difference between perceiving the shape and position of a rose or an ice cube and experiencing redness or coldness. Humphrey suspected that Helen was making use of visual perceptions without having any conscious visual sensations, using her eyes to gather facts about the world without having the experience of seeing. Humphrey's doctoral supervisor, Larry Weiskrantz, soon made a complimentary discovery. He observed a human patient, a partially blind man who was missing half his visual cortex, making consistently accurate guesses about the shape, position, and color of objects in the blind region of his visual field. Weiskrantz named this ability blind sight. Blind sight suggested a lot about the workings of the brain, but it also posed fundamental questions about the nature of consciousness. If it's possible to navigate the world using only non-conscious perceptions, then why did humans, and possibly other species, evolved to feel such rich and varied sensations? In the 19th century, the biologist Thomas Henry Huxley had compared consciousness to the whistle of a train or the chiming of a clock. According to this view, known as epiphenomenalism, consciousness is just a side effect of a system that works without it. It accompanies, but doesn't affect, the flow of neural events. At first glance, blind sight seemed to support this view. As Humphrey asks in a new book, Sentience, the Invention of Consciousness, what would be wrong or insufficient for survival with deaf hearing, scentless smell, feelingless touch, or even painless pain? In more than half a dozen books over the past four decades, Humphrey has argued that consciousness is not just the whistle on the train, but part of its engine. In his view, our ability to have conscious experiences shapes our motives and psychology in ways that are evolutionarily advantageous. Sensations motivate us in an obvious way. Wounds feel bad, orgasms feel good. But they also make possible a set of sensation-seeking activities, play, exploration, imagination, that have helped us to learn more about ourselves and to thrive. And they make us better social psychologists because they allow us to grasp the feelings and motives of other people by consulting our own. The more mysterious and unworldly the qualities of phenomenal consciousness, the felt sensations of properties such as color, smell, and sound, the more significant the self, he writes. And the more significant the self, the greater the value that people will have placed on their own and others' lives. Humphrey quotes the poet Byron, who wrote that, quote, the great object of life is sensation, to feel that we exist even though in pain, end quote. And he often advances views with an aesthetic quality that reflects his own wide-ranging life. He left Cambridge at the age of 39 to write books, host television shows, travel, and read as widely as possible. He has studied gorillas with the primatologist Diane Fossey and edited the literary journal Granta. Although he later returned to Cambridge and held other prestigious academic positions, his work doesn't fit neatly within a single academic discipline. Humphrey holds a doctorate in psychology, but he is more engaged in philosophical arguments than a traditional psychologist would be. The philosopher Daniel Dennett, who is one of his longtime friends and intellectual sparring partners, told me that some philosophers view Humphrey as an interloper trespassing on their terrain. More broadly, Humphrey's views on consciousness subtly challenge many current ideas. The startling performance of software programs like ChatGPT has convinced some observers that machine consciousness is imminent. Recently, a law in the UK recognized many animals, including crabs and lobsters, as sentient. From Humphrey's point of view, these attitudes are misguided. Artificially intelligent machines are all perception, no sensation. They'll never be sentient so long as they only process information. And animals such as reptiles and insects, which face little evolutionary pressure to develop the grasp of other minds, are also very unlikely to be sentient. If we don't understand what sentience is for, we are likely to see it everywhere. Conversely, once we perceive its practical value, we will acknowledge its rarity. After reading Sentience, I contacted Humphrey. He told me that after a vacation in the Peloponnese in Greece, he and his wife, Isla, a clinical psychologist, would have a free day in Athens, where I live. I suggested that we visit the foothills of Mount Hymettus, where we could see a cave in which the god Pan and the nymphs were worshipped in antiquity. Some early archaeologists have suggested, speculatively, that the cave in the foothills of Mount Hymettus is the basis for the one that Plato describes in his famous allegory, in which prisoners confuse the flickering fire-cast shadows on a cavern's wall with reality. Humphrey has likened consciousness to a Platonic shadow play performed in an internal theater to impress the soul. Humphrey is a young 79. When the three of us met on a warm fall afternoon, he wore khaki pants and a green polo, looking less pink than most British vacationers in Greece. He led me to his and Isla's rental car, speaking in precise, onrushing sentences about the archaeology that he and Isla had seen in the Peloponnese and the architecture of the buildings around us. His philosopher friends, he told me, were jealous that he would be seeing the cave that might have inspired Plato. He broke into a broad smile as we reached the car. "I'm quite looking forward to this," he said. Philosophical spelunking would be a new sensation. Humphrey was born in 1943 in London into an illustrious family of intellectuals. His father was an immunologist and his mother a psychoanalyst who worked with Anna Freud. His maternal grandfather, A.V. Hill, had won a Nobel Prize for work on the physiology of muscle contraction, and the economist John Maynard Keynes was a great uncle. Home was a Scottish baronial mansion with more than 24 rooms. Humphrey, his 4 siblings, and their 15 cousins roamed the neighborhood and played hide-and-seek and other games. When Humphrey was 8, he left for boarding school, where the highlight of each year was a dramatic production. He starred in Richard II and Romeo and Juliet before he was in his teens. In 1961, when he arrived as an undergraduate at Cambridge, he found his physiology tutor, Giles Brindley, standing shirtless in a salt bath, wearing a helmet from which a metal rod projected against his right eye. Inspired by an experiment that Isaac Newton had conducted on himself in the 1660s, Brindley was running an electric current through the rod to his retina in order to study phosphenes, the visual sensations produced by pressure on the eyes. Humphrey tried the setup for himself, seeing the phosphenes when the current stimulated his retina. Later, he would realize that they embodied Reed's distinction between perception and sensation. They were visual sensations that did not correspond to perceptions about the world. How do our brains, which are made of the same stuff as everything else, create sensations? No other objects, tables, engines, laptops, have interiority, and when we look at neurons, nothing that we can observe suggests how they generate it. Some philosophers find consciousness with its qualitative sensations, the scratchiness of sandpaper, the saltiness of anchovies, the blueness of the sky, hard to reconcile with a standard view of matter. The existence of consciousness seems to imply that the physical description of the universe, in spite of its richness and explanatory power, is only part of the truth, the philosopher Thomas Nagel has written. Some thinkers have suggested that understanding consciousness may be too difficult for human brains. Others have proposed that all matter is conscious to some degree, a position called panpsychism. Humphrey sees consciousness as wondrous but not intractably mysterious. He has his own theory about how it's generated by the brain, involving feedback loops between its motor and sensory regions. But however it works, he argues, it must have evolved through natural selection, and this, in turn, means that conscious sensations must be valuable in their own right. In Sentience, he asks readers to imagine the mind as a library. The texts of the books that it contains are our perceptions, providing relevant information about the world. At some point in evolutionary history, a subclass of books developed illustrations. These helped us to value, experience, and understand the texts in new ways. Sensations vividly represent what our perceptions mean to us. If perceptions make life possible, sensations make it worth living. They have also allowed our species to enter a new landscape of possibility, what Humphrey calls the soul niche. In this evolutionary niche, we use our sensations to better enjoy and understand ourselves, one another, and the world. Humphrey took the wheel as we set out for Mount Hymettus. He interrupted my directions with a smooth stream of philosophical and autobiographical commentary. I soon learned that his poodle, Bernie, is named for Bernie Sanders. As I answered his questions about what rent is like in Athens, it's not so bad. Motorcycles swerved around us, and the sea glimmered through the windows on the right. I wondered if a good self-driving car, perceiving the reality of the road without being distracted by conscious sensations, might be better at navigating the Athenian traffic. On the other hand, the sensations of the drive, the smell of exhaust, the sharp glare of sunlight, the tingles of sudden swerves and accelerations, felt both inescapably absorbing and casually potent. If they were just epiphenomena, like the whistle on a train engine, they were lavish extravagances. Knowing that I had studied ancient Greek, Humphrey began reciting the opening lines of an ancient tragedy in the original language. Then he said, glancing at me, "I played the god Dionysus in a school production of Euripides' Bacchae when I was 12. We were arriving at a vast three-lane traffic circle. I looked to the other cars. As I turned back to Humphrey, he paused his narration, joining the flow of traffic, and then launched into a story about a statue in antiquity that had been tried in a court of law for falling onto and crushing someone. "It's like the criminal trials of animals in Europe in the Middle Ages," he said, starting to drift between lanes on a busy avenue. "Nick, let's choose a lane," Isla called from the back seat in a slightly anxious voice. Sensations, Humphrey thinks, make us interested in stories, ideas, and experiences. Because our lives feel like something, we can also better imagine what others are feeling. Sensing Isla's apprehension, Humphrey refocused on the road. Humphrey has come to his views gradually, often drawing on unusual experiences. As an undergraduate at Cambridge, he joined the Society for Psychical Research, a half-serious organization devoted to studying the supernatural. A philosophy professor introduced the group to an eccentric Englishman on the Italian island of Elba, who believed that he received divine dictation from a spirit guide who was a Tibetan monk. The Englishman invited a delegation from the society to come and investigate him, and Humphrey and two friends spent a week as his guests, watching as he scribbled the spirit guide's teachings while in a trance, and then accompanying him in his Rolls Royce as he drove into the mountains to picnic. "I was coming to see that there's something dreamily mad about human consciousness," Humphrey later wrote of the episode. In the 1980s, Humphrey left his position at Cambridge to work on a public television series about the history of the human mind. He traveled with a film crew to County Cork in Ireland, where people had reported that a statue of the Virgin Mary that stood in a hillside grotto rocked its head slightly when they prayed to it after dusk. Observing the statue at night from a distance, Humphrey saw what everyone else did, the appearance of motion. He and his team later found an explanation for the illusion. Receptor cells in the human eye perceive bright and dim lights as moving at different speeds. As the worshipper standing beneath the grotto shifted slightly on their feet, the statue seemed to move. To Humphrey, the swaying virgin was almost a metaphor for consciousness, an accidental trick of the light that appeared miraculous. Consciousness, too, might have evolved as a kind of physiological accident, then proved captivating in a way that mattered. In 1971, at the invitation of Diane Fossey, Humphrey spent 2 months in the mountains of Rwanda studying a group of silverback gorillas. He started by performing cranial measurements on the skulls of dead animals, and then moved on to observing the living gorillas from a nest in the trees. He was fascinated by their constant social dramas, and quickly saw that shifting alliances and power struggles could be a matter of life and death. The gorillas lacked natural predators and had an abundant food supply. Their large brains seemed almost unnecessary. But in a widely cited paper, Humphrey used his observations of the gorillas to argue that navigating social dynamics had driven increases in intelligence in multiple social species. The process unfolded in a feedback loop. To understand others' experiences, we need to consult our own. We therefore become better social psychologists by broadening and deepening our reservoirs of conscious sensation. Because stories and imaginative literature let us do this, Humphrey sees an adaptive role for immersing ourselves in the vicarious worlds of narrative and drama. His own work reflects a lifelong love of reading in many genres, and his books brim with the testimonies of poets, artists, and mystics who hymn the delights of sentience. Humphrey quotes the English poet Rupert Brooke, who, in a letter to a depressed friend, suggested that he might be helped by just looking at people and things as themselves, neither as useful, nor moral, nor ugly, nor anything else, but just as being. In a flicker of sunlight on a blank wall, or a reach of muddy pavement, or smoke from an engine at night, there is a sudden significance and importance and inspiration that makes the breath stop with a gulp of certainty and a happiness. Humphrey believes that human beings have evolved to take intrinsic delight in conscious sensation for its own sake. He suspects that we're probably not the only creatures to enjoy our sentience. Animals such as wolves and crows also live in social groups and engage in sensation-seeking, and so are plausible candidates. Videos show rooks sledding, swans surfing, and monkeys leaping from high ledges into pools of water. By contrast, convincing examples of insects or reptiles engaging in this sort of sensory play are hard to find. To a degree, Humphrey's initial question about Helen, the blind-sighted monkey, why is blind sight or deaf hearing insufficient for survival, has a simple answer. It's not. Even if creatures like insects and reptiles lack sentience, it's hardly kept them from proliferating. Yet, the flourishing of land animals does not diminish the adaptive value of flight. Perhaps the first conscious beings to enter Humphrey's soul niche were something like the first creatures to fly. They were earlier explorers of a lofty domain in which entirely new sets of goals and activities became possible. Humphrey feels strongly about these issues and wants to change the minds of others as well. One morning last July, he joined a discussion led by Jonathan Birch, a philosopher at the London School of Economics, whose work helped drive the Animal Welfare Sentience Act, a recent UK animal welfare law that promises to extend some protections to lobsters, crabs, and octopuses. Birch and a few graduate students have been reading and discussing a draft of Humphrey's new book. The group met in a seminar room, settling into a semicircle of red chairs with computers and coffee cups perched on laps and tables. The faces of a few Zoom participants hovered on a screen. After some introductory remarks, Humphrey, who enjoys cordial philosophical combat, suggested that, by Birch's definitions, a cruise missile would qualify as a sentient organism. It can detect damage and pain, take avoiding action, report back to base, he said. Birch, in shorts and a t-shirt, listened with a quizzical frown. I don't think cruise missiles feel... No, Birch said with a laugh. Do we agree on this? He glanced around the room at the students. Why not? Humphrey asked. He did not seem amused. They seem to mind about what happens to them. They're self-preserving. They can combine even in social groups. Birch chuckled. I'm sure you don't really believe this. You're trying to provoke. Humphrey pressed his point. If you're going to remain simply at the behavioral level, saying that any evidence of an animal taking in any information and apparently caring about it is feeling. Birch broke in. I think we agree about the importance of the cognitive level and looking for cognitive markers. During more than an hour of debate, agreement was elusive. The session ended amicably, with the in-person participants heading off for lunch. But debate between the senior scholars smoldered over email for several days. Whereas you invent an explanatory role for phenomenal consciousness in areas of cognition when there's no obvious requirement for it, I try to deduce a role for it by pointing to aspects of human psychology which neither would or could exist without it, Humphrey fumed to Birch in one email. Birch, in turn, argued that the function of phenomenal consciousness was most likely a facilitative one. It facilitates certain types of learning, integration, decision-making, and metacognition. In Humphrey's view, consciousness is not just an upgrade to the engine, but an overhaul. After half an hour of driving, we reached the southern suburbs of Athens. We turned onto a dirt road that rose through low, dry foothills dotted with olive trees. The road got rougher and steeper. Eventually, we pulled over and continued on foot. We slipped through an unlocked iron gate to find the mouth of the cave. A steep, crumbling staircase, carved into the limestone, descended into the shadows. Isla peered into the opening. The staircase had no railing, and the distance between steps varied widely. "I'll stay here," she said, perching on the lip. Some 15 feet below the opening, the air was cool and smelled faintly of minerals. A shelf of rock sloped away from us toward a fork. On one side was a narrower passage, its stone walls blackened by old fires. On the other side, carved steps led farther down. Crouching slightly, he went into the narrow passage. 18th and 19th century visitors had scratched their signatures into the rock, and Humphrey paused to trace the faded letters in the faint light. They represented only the cave's recent history. The first archaeologist to explore it in the early 20th century had found ancient coins, figurines, lamps, and other artifacts and inscriptions, some dating to as early as 600 BC. We came through an opening into a larger chamber. The walls and ceilings had a flowing quality, with patches of dark green and slicks of moisture. Stalactites and projections emerged in a profusion of odd shapes. A small altar was carved into the rock, likely dedicated to the god Pan. The chamber contained two ancient relief sculptures, a female figure seated on a platform, her face eroded beyond recognition, and a nearly life-size man shown in profile, holding a stone carver's tool. The base of the latter statue was inscribed with the name Archidamus. Perhaps it was a self-portrait of the sculptor. Standing there, I thought of the swaying statue of the Virgin in Ireland and of Plato. In the statue, Humphrey had seen a microcosm of consciousness, a captivating illusion that imbued reality with wonder and meaning. Plato could have conveyed his ideas with a simple set of propositions, but instead he went to the trouble of writing an allegory in which chained prisoners search for answers in eerie images from which they can't turn away. It was this sensual evocation, as much as the ideas it depicted, that had drawn us to this spot almost 2.5 millennia later. Visiting this cave with perceptions but no sensations would not feel like anything. There would be no way to savor the gloomy shadows, the cool, smooth limestone, or the mineral tang of rock and earth. Humphrey sat down on a rock to rest. "Do you know Shakespeare's 53rd sonnet?" he asked. "What is your substance? Whereof are you made? That millions of strange shadows on you tend." He paused, looking around. When we experience the magical properties of sensations, colors, pains, and so on, we assume they correspond to something real, the substance of consciousness. But, of course, he went on, it could be an illusion. The shadows could be all there is. He wiped a hand across his brow. The sound of Isla's voice came drifting down. It was late afternoon, and Humphrey still wanted to get back to Athens, change clothes, and clarify a few philosophical points over a dinner of mixed grill and white wine at a restaurant downtown. We took a picture of Humphrey smiling slightly beside an ancient sculpture and a short video, so that Isla could feel some of what we had. Then we started climbing toward the light. And now, from the March 20th, 2023 issue of the New Yorker magazine, How America Manufactures Poverty. The sociologist Matthew Desmond identifies specific practices and policies that consign tens of millions to destitution, by Margaret Talbot. Books about poverty tend to be books about the poor, the sociologist Matthew Desmond writes in Poverty by America, published by Crown. That's true whether the motivation is to blame the poor for their lot, chronicling the supposed pathologies, creating a culture of poverty, or more commonly nowadays, to generate empathy via detailed ethnographies of survival and agency amid deprivation. It was true of the first books that set out to systematically map and measure poverty, such as the Victorian reformer Charles Booth's 17-volume Life and Labor of the People in London. When Michael Harrington wrote his 1962 classic The Other America, a work of morally charged narrative nonfiction often credited with helping to inspire the war on poverty, his aim was to reveal the socially invisible poor to the rest of America. A cocoon of post-war prosperity and complacency, he wrote, blinkered middle-class women coming in from suburbia on a rare trip, who might catch the merest glimpse of the other America on the way to an evening at the theater. It also blinkered the business or professional man, who might drive along the fringes of slums in a car or bus, without regarding it as an important experience. The book's dominant rhetorical modes, as Harrington's biographer Maurice Isserman notes, were paradox and revelation. If the scales were pulled from the eyes of his well-meaning readers, they would see, in the shadows of American plenty, tens of millions of poor people, whom Harrington cataloged and described. Rural poor, city-dwelling slum poor, alcoholic skid row poor, and so on. All of them urgently needing the help of the government and liberal elites. Even a book like Charles Murray's Losing Ground, an influential neocon attack on welfare dependency from 1984, focused on the poor themselves, if only so that Murray might make an argument about how they had immiserated themselves by adapting to anti-poverty policies. Desmond's terrific previous book, Evicted, published in 2016, is emphatically about the lives of the poor. It followed eight struggling families trying to stay housed in Milwaukee, where, in the poorest neighborhoods, median rent for a two-bedroom apartment was only $50 less than the citywide median. Families were spending up to 70% of their monthly incomes on housing that might have stopped up plumbing, broken windows, filthy carpets, and front doors that wouldn't lock. And when they fell behind on rent for any of the multitude of reasons that people living precariously do, a trip to the emergency room, an unexpected car repair, a steep utility bill paid to keep the lights on or the heat on, they faced the chaos and humiliation of eviction. Evicted illuminated big and sometimes novel themes, the outsized role of housing costs in the creation and perpetuation of poverty across the nation, the fact that evictions have become so common that businesses found ways to profit from them. Moving companies, for instance, would extract the last of a tenant's belongings down to the shower curtain in the bathroom and place them in storage, which would cost more than many tenants had to reclaim them. But the book's power resided in its stories, which Desmond told with a keen eye for detail and scene-setting drama. His reporting was intimate and particular. Jory and his cousin were cutting up, tossing snowballs at passing cars, reads the first line of the book's prologue, evocatively named Cold City. One of those snowballs proved fateful. The driver of the car it hit got mad and kicked in the door of Jory's mom's apartment. The landlord evicted the family. Evicted, which won the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction, was almost universally acclaimed, praised especially for the vividness of its portraiture. So it's brave, in a way, that Desmond has chosen such a different approach for his bracing new book. Books about the poor are vital, he says. They do the important work of bearing witness. But Poverty by America, he explains, is a book about how and why the rest of us abide poverty and are complicit in it. Why do many of us seem to accept that the problem is one of scarcity, that there is simply not enough to go around in our very rich country? Where there is exploitation, there are exploiters. And this time Desmond sees many more of them, including most of his prospective readers. Corporations batten on low-wage labor, but so do consumers, who have come to expect that cheap goods and services. The illusory frictionless food deliveries, the Amazon orders that arrive like conjuring tricks the afternoon you place them, that poorly paid, non-unionized, often temporary workers provide. Landlords are not the only ones who benefit from housing exploitation. Many homeowners do, too. Their property values propped up by the collective effort to make housing scarce and expensive, Desmond writes, noting that most homeowners receive federal aid in the form of mortgage interest deductions and other subsidies. The payout to homeowners in 2020, $193 billion, far exceeded the $53 billion in direct housing assistance that the government gave to low-income families. We need not be debt collectors or private prison wardens to play a role in producing poverty in America, Desmond goes on. We need only to vote yes on policies that lead to private opulence and public squalor, and with that opulence, build a life behind a wall that we tend and maintain. More manifesto than narrative, poverty by America is urgent and accessible. It is also austere. There are not many stories about individuals. Desmond seems to dole these out with purposeful spareness, perhaps so that we won't get distracted by them. But the one he tells about himself is affecting. Before he went to graduate school at the University of Wisconsin, or won a MacArthur, or became a professor at Princeton, Desmond grew up outside a little town near Flagstaff, Arizona, living with his family in a modest wood-paneled house that he loved. Then his father, a pastor, lost his job, and the bank took the family's home. "Mostly I blamed Dad," he writes. "But a part of me also wondered why this was our country's answer when a family fell on hard times." He kept wondering while he was in college, using scholarships and loans at Arizona State University, supporting himself as a barista, a telemarketer, and a wildland firefighter. The question compelled him to write Evicted. Behind that question, always, were the bigger questions that animate this new book. How is it that the United States, a country with a gross domestic product larger than the combined economies of Japan, Germany, the United Kingdom, India, France, and Italy, has a higher relative poverty rate than those other advanced democracies? Why do 1 in 8 Americans and 1 in 6 children live in poverty, a rate about the same as it was in 1970? Why do we put up with it? The short answer, Desmond argues, is that as a society, we have made a priority of other things. Maximal wealth accumulation for the few and cheap stuff for the many. At the same time, we have either ignored or enabled the gouging of the poor by big banks that charge them stiff overdraft fees, by predatory payday lenders and check-cashing outlets of what Desmond calls the fringe banking industry, by landlords who squeeze their tenants because the side hustle of rent collecting has turned into their main hustle, by companies that underpay their workers or deny them benefits by confining them to gig status, or that keep them perpetually off balance with just-in-time scheduling of shifts. To the extent that middle and upper-class people unthinkingly buy products from such companies and invest in their stock or park their money in those banks, or oppose public housing in their neighborhoods despite a professed commitment to it, or bid up the prices of fixer-uppers in Austin or San Francisco or Washington, D.C., they too are helping to buttress the system. You might assume that government action would do more to help, maybe even to lower the poverty rate. Programs like food stamps, the Earned Income Tax Credit, and temporary assistance for needy families are lifelines for many. Recent research suggests that even public housing, much maligned, is strikingly beneficial for the families that can get a spot, which can involve a years-long wait. The intimidating towers are now far outnumbered by more dispersed and approachable low-rises. Children who grow up in public housing show lower lead levels in their bloodstreams, more robust mental health, and better results in school than those whose families are scraping by in the private housing market, according to a trio of recent studies. A fourth study, published last year in the American Economic Journal, found that kids who lived in public housing had higher incomes and lower rates of incarceration as young adults. Moreover, it turns out that the United States is not all that tight-fisted when it comes to social spending. If you count all public benefits offered by the federal government, America's welfare state, as a share of its gross domestic product, is the second biggest in the world, after France's, Desmond tells us. Why doesn't this largesse accomplish more? For one thing, it unduly assists the affluent. That statistic about the U.S. spending almost as much as France on social welfare, he explains, is accurate only if you include things like government-subsidized retirement benefits provided by employers, student loans and 529 college savings plans, child tax credits, and homeowner subsidies, benefits disproportionately flowing to Americans well above the poverty line. To enjoy most of these, you need to have a well-paying job, a home that you own, and probably an accountant, and, if you're really in clover, a money manager. The American government gives the most help to those who need it least, Desmond argues. This is the true nature of our welfare state, and it has far-reaching implications, not only for our bank accounts and poverty levels, but also for our psychology and civic spirit. Americans who benefit from social spending in the form of, say, a mortgage interest tax deduction, don't see themselves as recipients of governmental generosity. The boon it offers them may be as hard for them to recognize and acknowledge as the persistence of poverty once was to Harrington's suburban housewives and professional men. These Americans may be anti-government and vote that way. They may picture other people, poor people, as weak and dependent and themselves as hard-working and upstanding. Desmond allows that one reason for this is that tax breaks don't feel the same as direct payments, although they may amount to the same thing for household incomes and for the federal budget. You can benefit a family by lowering its tax burden or by increasing its benefits. Same difference. They are associated with an obligation and a procedure that Americans in particular find onerous. Tax-cutting Republican lawmakers want the process to be both difficult and Swiss-cheesed with loopholes. Taxes should hurt, Ronald Reagan once said. But that's not the only reason. What Desmond calls the rudest explanation is that if, for whatever reason, we get a tax break, most of us like it. That's the case for people affluent and lucky enough to take advantage of the legitimate breaks designed for their benefit, and for the wily super rich who game the system with expensive lawyering and ingenious use of tax shelters. And there are other ways, Desmond points out, that government help gets thwarted or misdirected. When President Clinton instituted welfare reform in 1996, pledging to transform a broken system that traps too many people in a cycle of dependence, an older model, Aid to Families with Dependent Children, or AFDC, was replaced by Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or TANF. Where most funds administered by AFDC went straight to families in the form of cash aid, TANF gave grants to states with the added directive to promote two-parent families and discourage out-of-wedlock childbirth, and let the states fund programs to achieve those goals as they saw fit. As a result, states have come up with rather creative ways to spending TANF dollars, Desmond writes. Nationwide, for every dollar budgeted for TANF in 2020, poor families directly received just 22 cents. Only Kentucky and the District of Columbia spent over half of their TANF funds on basic cash assistance. Between 1999 and 2016, Oklahoma directed more than $70 million toward initiatives to promote marriage, offering couples counseling and workshops that were mostly open to people of all income levels. Arizona used some of the funds to pay for abstinence education. Pennsylvania gave some of its TANF money to anti-abortion programs. Mississippi treated its TANF funds as an unexpected Christmas present, hiring a Christian rock singer to perform at concerts, for instance, and a former professional wrestler, the author of an autobiography titled Every Man Has His Price, to deliver inspirational speeches. Much of this was revealed by assiduous investigative reporters and by a 2020 audit of Mississippi's Department of Human Services. Moreover, because states don't have to spend all their TANF funds each year, many carry over big sums. In 2020, Tennessee, which has one of the highest child poverty rates in the nation, left $790 million in TANF funds unspent. Poverty by America is a slim book, at fewer than 300 pages of text, but it is packed with revelations like these, and with statistics and studies, though, fortunately, a reader need never find herself stranded in a thicket of them. 70-odd pages of endnotes help take care of that problem. Desmond writes particularly well about the ways in which the poor, though they're said to be hidden from the rest of us, have never escaped the notice of the markets. For years, big banks treated overdraft fees as a reliable stream of income, extracted from the chronically overdrawn. In 2020, the average fee for overdrawing your account was $33.58. And because banks can charge these fees multiple times a day, a tiny overdraft can rack up fees of more than $100 in a matter of hours. Payday loan stores and check cashing outlets step in where banks fear to tread and make good money off the venture. Unlike traditional banks, they are more common in low-poverty black neighborhoods than in high-poverty white ones. Black and Hispanic families are five times as likely to have no bank account as white families are. The reason these lenders charge extortionate fees is, Desmond says, not that the poor are such risky prospects. Most payday borrowers ultimately pay back the loans. But that in a market where the poor have little choice, it's easy to make money off of them. Desmond quotes an observation of James Baldwin's to this point. Anyone who has ever struggled with poverty knows how extremely expensive it is to be poor. And Desmond offers solutions as well, scattered throughout the book and exhibiting varying levels of ambition. The relatively simple ones include helping people claim the aid owed to them. Less than a quarter of families eligible for TANF cash receive it. Less than half of elderly Americans who could apply for food stamps do. The phenomenon is so widespread across social programs that Desmond maintains it's more appropriate to speak of welfare avoidance than of welfare dependency. Yet there are small fixes that have been shown to make a difference, including better designed applications and targeted assistance with filling out forms. The harder goals include raising the federal minimum wage from $7.25 an hour, a rate at which it has been lodged since 2009, and having the Secretary of Labor oversee its regular resetting, a method closer to what many other countries do, rather than waiting for Congress to act. Other measures, supporting unions, still the best way to empower workers, calling on states to better regulate payday lending, making sure that people have access to contraception and abortion, a little tricky these days, since these are proven ways of keeping women and children out of poverty. Making it easier for the poor to become homeowners. Monthly mortgage payments are generally far less than rent. By getting the government to provide additional backing for small mortgages when banks won't offer them. A program that encourages rural homeownership in this way already exists. Creating more public housing so that people don't have to languish on waiting lists. Eliminating exclusionary zoning policies that ban apartments or other multifamily dwellings in higher income neighborhoods. Making sure that developers are then given incentives through tax relief, for example, to set aside percentages of the housing for low income families. That last part is important. You don't want a scenario in which Rich developers get richer off industrial chic condos designed for moneyed singles, while city officials congratulate themselves on their commitment to urban density. And it's tough to pull off. Desmond cites New Jersey as having become a leader in this regard ever since its Supreme Court issued a series of rulings in the 1970s and 80s that produced what's known as the Mount Laurel Doctrine, requiring municipalities to offer a fair share of affordable housing, the fair share varying by town's income distribution. He says that the policy has forced hundreds of towns in New Jersey to break ground on affordable housing developments. Unfortunately, as he doesn't say, the Mount Laurel Doctrine has also been somewhat undercut by elected officials, cleverly exploited by developers, including the Kushner family, and slowed by litigation. Still, it's a start. Finally, Desmond wants us to think of ourselves as poverty abolitionists. He wants us to bear in mind a company's labor policies when we make decisions about where to invest and what to buy, to conquer NIMBYish instincts and welcome true economic diversity in our neighborhoods and schools, to think about and act on our own roles in perpetuating income inequality. The goal is singular, to end the exploitation of the poor, but the means are many, he writes. It's an appealingly ad hoc and flexible approach. In part because this book is aimed at the hearts and minds of the widest possible swath of readers, it doesn't have much to say about politics. To be a poverty abolitionist means avoiding businesses that don't treat their workers fairly, as some people shun businesses that contribute to global warming or promote tobacco products or engage in animal cruelty. But in the absence of politically organized public boycotts, such actions won't be legible to companies. If on my own I stop mailing packages by FedEx and switch to UPS, FedEx employees generally are not unionized, Desmond points out, while UPS employees generally are. Will anybody notice? Perhaps because Congress and many state governments are in the hands of a Republican Party that sees the mildest adjustments of pure market forces as redistributive pit stops on the road to socialist hell, it's discouraging to talk about electoral or legislative politics. Activists and elected officials who want to take up his proposals will have to devise their own strategy. In this book, anyway, Desmond mostly sets aside the kind of systemic explanations, deindustrialization, globalization, neoliberal ideology, even capitalism itself, that have held sway in progressive circles for a long time now. We typically don't talk about poverty as a condition that benefits some of us, he writes. It seems we prefer more absolving theories of the problem. There is, of course, the old habit of blaming the poor for their own miseries, as if Americans were made of lesser stuff than people in countries with far less poverty. But structural explanations are more in fashion these days. Explanations that trace widespread poverty back to broken institutions and seismic economic transformations. At times, Desmond's dismissal of such analysis seems too quick. He complains about the passivity of a word like deindustrialization, the way it can make the phenomenon sound like an unintentional calamity. Fair enough, but it's still a useful term, and one that he relied on in Evicted to discuss the loss of manufacturing jobs in Milwaukee. In fact, one of the more encouraging findings Desmond cites is a 2020 Pew survey showing that a large majority of Americans have come to blame structural obstacles, not personal failings, for poverty, and to believe that most of the rich got that way not through hard work, but through advantages. That's a big shift in a country that has long been enamored of bootstrap mythology. It seems like a precondition for taking poverty abolition seriously and believing it to be possible. And presumably, some of that shift can be attributed to structural analysis of inequality and the way it has trickled down into familiar talk about the 1%. Moreover, even if, as he notes, systemic racism and poverty are made up of untold numbers of individual decisions motivated by real or imagined self-interest. Some kinds of self-interest, that of international corporations, for example, are a lot more powerful than other kinds. Still, Desmond is right to warn us that a dependence on such buzzwords can have the effect of excusing us, soothing away the apprehension that those of us who abhor such forces are getting something out of their machinations nonetheless. And it's refreshing to read a work of social criticism that eschews the easy and often smug allure of abstraction in favor of plain-spoken practicality. Poverty by America deserves to be one of those books you see people reading on the subway or handing around at organizing meetings or citing in congressional hearings. Its moral force is a gut punch. And as usual, I'll end with some poetry. First, from the October 20th, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Library of Congress, by Arthur Sizz. You peer down a lit corridor on the fifth tier of stacks, where a million books breathe on shelves. Here's a book on neutrinos captured in Antarctica. Here's another on solar flares. A curator displays a book in Vi script and points to a triangle with two dots. You wonder if you are looking at a pregnant woman, an enslaved man, or a human ear. You pull a book off a shelf and opening it hear del aire, al aire, como, and then snap it shut. The air hums with honeybees. A second curator points at glittering gold script, though you can't divine a word. You guess Farsi and dive into the marlin blue depth of the page. A third curator shows you Chinese writing, woodblock, printed on mulberry paper. And as you read, a distant mind leaves the earth around it. You smell daylilies in a courtyard and know you may caravan to Timbuktu. But there's no pear blossom end to what's within reach. We've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or printed blind. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.